together for the afternoon. So if you want to go ahead and grab a seat, we'll get started in just a minute here. We're going to keep trekking through Ecclesiastes together. As we mentioned, several of Jim's, not all, but certainly most of Jim's books are in the back on the table for you to kind of look at. He writes at different levels, so some are more commentaries, some are books on theology, and some are more maybe practically bent. I was going to mention just a few of his books to you, kind of by way of brief introduction, how they might serve you. They're not probably all for everyone, but there may be one or two here that you say, yeah, I'd be interested in reading that. If you're a part of our church, I did not check, but several of these I know are in the library, so you would be able to potentially check them out. This is not Jim's first book, but I think this is the book that maybe most people became aware of his ministry as a result. So at first he had his dissertation published regarding the Holy Spirit's role in the Old Testament. And then he wrote God's Glory in Salvation Through Judgment, a Biblical Theology. So just making good textual, structural observations from all of the Bible. So it'd be one of those things where if you said, hey, I wanted maybe a one-book commentary on the whole Bible, this would be something like that. But it's not going to maybe have a paragraph on that verse you're wondering about. But it might help you put it in the context of that chapter or that book, and especially the structure of it. It has lots of great charts. So before I preach a book, I will read or reread the section in here on that book. It helps orient me quickly. Maybe like the introduction to a study Bible would. Another maybe helpful, accessible book is Jim's What is Biblical Theology? A Guide to the Bible Story, Symbolism, and Patterns. So he defines biblical theology, which is a term that can be used several different ways. It can mean not unbiblical theology. It could also be just a theme in the Bible, is a biblical theology of. He would define it, he does here at the beginning, as the phrase biblical theology is used here to refer to the interpretive perspective of the biblical authors. And then he just works that out, which is what he's done in his others. But this is a real accessible. If you're new to the idea of biblical theology, this would be a great accessible book to pick up. He also has a book for kids. So this is great. We have read this with our kids. It's very brief. It's for younger kids. I don't know if there's an age, preschool, early school. And then pertinent to the topic today is a theology of work, biblical theology on work, which obviously would overlap a good bit with themes in Ecclesiastes. And then the last thing I'll just mention is, you know, apart from, you know, sermons on Kenwood's website, Nine Marks has a podcast called Bible Talk, and Alex Duke and Sam Amati and Jim Hamilton are working their way through the Bible. And you're in Chronicles or something? End of Kings. So they started in Genesis and have talked through the Bible in order and are now in Kings. And there's no book to represent it, but this kind of came out of that, which would be an overview of Genesis, a very intro level. Anyone here, if you can read, you would benefit from this introduction to Genesis. Is that good, Kevin? Is that great? All right. Let me pray for Jim, and then he'll come back up. Father God, we ask that you would just bless this time. Bless our brother as he comes. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
All right. So we continue in Ecclesiastes. We saw this morning that the first section of the book raises the question, what does man gain by his toil, by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? Chapter 1, verse 3. That question's repeated in 3:9. What gain has the worker from his toil? And then we also overviewed the whole book where I suggested how the book is laid out, and it falls into these divisions, I think. The second section, 3:16 through 6:12, is what we're going to look at in this session. And I think the big question here has to do with injustice and oppression. So this is introduced at 3:16, and we worked this morning. We read through 3:16 through 22. So I'm just going to summarize. I think essentially what Solomon says there is, in the place of justice, there was wickedness. And in the place of righteousness, there was wickedness. So he's pointing to the way that people unjustly oppress others. And his answer to that is immediately provided. Now, I want to make a comment here about something that if you look into commentaries on Ecclesiastes, you'll run into commentators using this as an argument as to why Solomon was not the author of the book. And they'll say, well, Solomon was the king, and in these various parts of the book, he's complaining about injustice. And if he was the king, if it was actually Solomon who wrote the book, he would be in position to fix that problem of injustice. In response to which I want to say, well, how shallow of a thinker are you? You know, do you not, I mean, these people are academics, so I want to say to them, do you not think about the faculty meetings that you sit in on? You know, the fact that you're the president of the institution doesn't mean that you can eradicate injustice and oppression from the experience of your faculty. The fact that Solomon is the king of Israel does not mean that he can root injustice and oppression out of the hearts of the people. And so his response to this is 3:17, God will judge. And then as he continues to reflect, he's saying, people are going to die, and the problem is they don't think about that reality. They don't consider the fact that like beasts, they're going to die, they're going to face judgment, and then they're going to deal with the ramifications of the way that they've lived in the afterlife. I think that's really what he's going after there. Now, in chapter 4, which is what we're going to look at next, I think what Solomon does here is trace out the outworkings of unjust oppression. In other words, if you decide I'm going to participate in this, I'm going to get me some of this, I'm going to benefit from injustice and oppression, it's like Solomon says, okay, let's think this through. Let's think about where this is going to go. So let's start reading in chapter 4, verses 1 through 3, where he writes, again, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun, and behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors, there was power, and there was no one to comfort them. And I thought the dead, who are already dead, more fortunate than the living who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been and has not seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun. Which this is a pretty severe statement to make. He's basically saying it would be better to be dead than to experience the injustice and oppression that is perpetrated. And better than that would be never to have lived to experience this. I don't think this should be taken as a cynical, skeptical, existentialist, absurdist statement. Rather, this is someone who's recognizing righteousness is righteous and wickedness is evil. And wickedness is so bad that it would be better never to have experienced it. Even never to have been born in this world than to experience this manner of wickedness and evil. That perspective is affirming the goodness of righteousness. And I think that's what Solomon is doing here. So the first kind of, it's almost like he's presenting arguments against oppression here. And his first argument, as if speaking to oppressors, he's saying, do you realize how painful you make life for other people? Do you contemplate how bad the wickedness that you're perpetrating is? And then in this next section, and I would just note here how, notice how in 4:1 he says, again I saw, and then he's going to start the same way in 4:4, then I saw. So I think he's moved into a new idea here in 4:4. Then I saw that all toil and all skill in work come from a man's envy of his neighbor. Now, there's a way in which I think this is true all the time, that that competition is natural, that striving to exceed or match someone else is just a feature of human experience. But in this context, I think he's particularly addressing the rivalry and the striving that oppressors and unjust people engage in. So I think he's particularly pointing to the wickedness of the way that unjust oppressors are often seeking to outdo one another, and they're in envious rivalry with one another. And he says this also is breath or vanity and a striving after wind. In other words, you're not going to really be satisfied if this is the way you pursue life. You're constantly trying to outdo someone else. And then this next statement in 4:6, I think it's almost as though he says, well, in 4, really, these next two statements, 4:5 and 4:6, it's almost like he says, here are two wrong ways to respond to that reality. The reality that envy and strife are often what's driving people to seek improvements. One wrong way is to not do anything, and that's described in verse 5. The fool folds his hands and devours, eats his own flesh. In other words, he decides, okay, what's driving people to improve or to be productive is just rivalry. So to avoid that, I'm not going to do anything. And Solomon, I think his counsel is, that's the wrong way to respond. And then verse 6, better is a handful of quietness than two hands full of toil and striving after the wind. And I think what he's recommending here is a way of pursuing your work that amounts to a handful of quietness, where you've got your hand full, but you also have achieved a kind of work-life balance where things are in proportion, they're where they need to be, and you're content with who you are and what you're doing. That's better than two hands full of toil and striving after wind, trying to do more than you can really do, and it's just ongoing, unceasing, no rest, all work, all the time. My next-door neighbor is a Louisville Cardinals fan, and if you've followed the Louisville Cardinals at all, you know that since Rick Pitino was our coach, we've kind of been on a downhill slide. And the coach between Pitino and the current coach, he said on one occasion in an interview with the media that he was trying to achieve a work-life balance. And my next-door neighbor was just disgusted with this. Her attitude was, I don't want to coach with a work-life balance. I want a coach that wins. So, you know, they didn't win, but he was content. And now he's fired. But anyway. The first argument against unjust oppression, 4:1-3, is the evil that it perpetrates against others. Second argument, 4:4-6, is this is all coming from rivalry, and it won't lead to your satisfaction. And then I think we move into a third section here in 4:7, where he says, again I saw. And this section in verses 7 and 8 is going to begin and end with references to vanity, or breath. So verse 7, again I saw breath under the sun. One person who has no other, either son or brother, yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, for whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? This also is breath and an unhappy business. So he begins with breath, ends with breath, or vanity, ends with vanity. And I think what he's getting at here is people who pursue this kind of unjust oppression, they destroy all relationships in their lives, and they drive other people away from themselves. They don't have strong family relationships. They don't have friendships. They're often isolated individuals who have ruined their lives, ruined others' lives, and all for what? This is the question there in 4:8. For whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? And then I think as he works toward the end of this chapter, here in 4:9-12, I think what he's going to recommend is a way of working that actually builds relationships, a way of working that builds community. So 4:9, two are better than one, because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up his fellow, but woe to him who is alone when he falls, and has not another to lift him up. Again, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. A threefold cord is not quickly broken. So it's almost as though I think Solomon is saying something like, wouldn't you rather work in such a way that other people enjoy being around you? Wouldn't you like to work in such a way that you can sustain ongoing, lasting relationships with other people instead of working in such a way that you just drive everyone away from yourself? And in the last section of chapter 4, I think that Solomon is going to use language that evokes figures from Israel's history. And the two figures in particular, I think that he's trying to evoke, are Joseph and Saul. So, verse 13, better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king. So, Joseph, as you know, was sold into slavery, and then once in slavery, he was wrongly accused. He was one who experienced unjust oppression, both from his brothers and from Potiphar's wife. And then he winds up in prison, from which he's exalted to the right hand of Pharaoh, and he winds up saving Israel, saving Egypt, and in a way saving the world through his wise stewardship of the 7 years of plenty. Better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king. I don't think that Solomon means to indict the Pharaoh that Joseph served as an old and foolish king. I think he has in view here Saul, who was an old and foolish king. And there are really interesting similarities between Joseph and David. And in both of their cases, it's like they go from being nothing to being exalted to a place of great influence, great prominence, great power. And whereas the Pharaoh in Joseph's day, he's happy to turn everything over to Joseph and let Joseph run everything, Saul responds to David's rise by wanting to kill him. And so I think Solomon has Saul in view when he refers to an old and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice. And then verse 14, this sounds like Joseph, for he went from prison to the throne, though in his own kingdom he had been born poor. You know, this would fit the circumstances of Joseph's life. Verse 15, I saw all the living who move about under the sun, along with that youth who was to stand in the king's place. There was no end of all the people, all of whom he led, yet those who come later will not rejoice in him. And this is reminiscent of the way that in the opening verses of Exodus, there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know about Joseph. And I think that Solomon here is recalling, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. What has been is what will be done. And don't think that you're going to achieve a lasting remembrance. You can even have someone like a Joseph or a David, and for all the good they do, they're going to be forgotten. And in the context, I think the implication is, if you're thinking about pursuing injustice that leads to oppression, you should think about what kind of legacy you're going to have, because you don't want the kind of legacy that the unjust oppressors leave. You want to live the kind of life that you can be happy about once you face judgment and meet the consequences, the ramifications of the way that you've lived. Okay, so I think chapter 4 is largely Solomon trying to goad his audience to reject for themselves injustice and oppression. It's almost like he's trying to convince us that is not the way to live. That is not the way to conduct business. Now in 5:1-9, I think he's going to continue to discuss injustice and oppression. And what he's particularly concerned about here is the way that we, not that we're tempted to engage in it, but the way that we respond to it when we see it. I think that's the particular issue that he's going to take up. So you'll see that there, if you're looking at an ESV like I am, there's a subhead before verse 8. And I think that that is a poorly placed subhead. I think this unit runs from 5, 1 through 9. So I would just disregard that subhead at over verse 8 and read 5, 1 through 9 together. Among other things, reasons for this would include, look at 5, 1, where he says, guard your steps. The Hebrew word for guard is the same verb used in Genesis 2:15 when Adam is charged to keep the garden. So you can translate the verb shamar as either guard or keep. And then the word cultivated in verse 9 is a form of the word work. So Adam is put in the garden in Genesis 2:15 to work and keep the garden. And in Hebrew, guard and cultivated are the first and last words of chapter 5, verses 1 through 9 of Ecclesiastes. And it's almost as though Solomon is saying, look, this is what you need to do. When you see oppression and injustice, so look at 5:8, if you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, if you see that, what you need to do is work and keep your garden. Shut your mouth. Don't be a dreamer. Mind your own business. That I think is what Solomon is saying here in 5:1-9. So let's work through this passage together. In 5:1 he says, guard your steps when you go to the house of God. Okay, the house of God is going to be the temple. And now think about what he's saying when he says, guard your steps. Do you remember what the Lord said to the serpent in Genesis 3:15? He said, I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed, and he will bruise your head, and you will bruise his heel. That's right. So it's like Solomon is saying, watch your step. Watch your step because the serpent wants to strike your heel. Guard your steps when you go to the house of God. To draw near to listen is better than to offer the sacrifice of fools. Now, in view of 5:8, I think what Solomon is saying is something like, you would be offering the sacrifice of fools if you go up to the temple and you make all these vows and all these promises to God about how you're going to cure the land of all injustice and oppression. I think that's the idea here. So he's saying, watch your step when you draw near to the temple. Shut your mouth to draw near to listen is better than to offer the sacrifice of fools. Verse 2, be not rash with your mouth, nor let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God. For God is in heaven, and you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few. This is another way to say, fear God. Fear God. And don't let your mouth get out ahead of yourself. Verse 3, for a dream comes with much business, and a fool's voice with many words. I think the kind of dream that he has in view is the kind of thing that dreamers talk about when they say they're going to change the world, when they say that they're going to make it so that everything is right and fair for everybody. I think this is directly what Solomon is speaking to. Verse 4, when you vow a vow to God, do not delay paying it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you vow. It is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. So again, I think the idea is, somebody sees injustice and oppression, and they go running off to the temple, and they make this vow, Lord, I'm going to fix this. And then they realize, oh, this is more complicated than I thought. This is more deeply rooted than I thought. And just when I get the right person in position to exercise some good influence, that person turns up corrupt. And it turns out I can't fix this. And now I've got to go back and somehow deal with this vow that I made that came out of my dream. Verse 6. Let not your mouth lead you into sin, and do not say before the messenger that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry at your voice and destroy the work of your hands? I think the idea is, you make that vow, you're sinning, and you're in trouble now before God because you made the promise, it's on you. Verse 7, for when dreams increase and words grow many, there is vanity, but God is the one you must fear. If you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter. For the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. So, in other words, you're always going to have layers upon layers of authority, and there's always going to be room for somebody in the chain to be corrupted by bribes or whatever, kickbacks, however this works. And so what you need to do is you need to guard your steps. And then verse 9, this is gain for a land in every way. A king committed to cultivated fields. And again, I think the idea of a cultivated field is a worked garden. So I think to summarize the message of 5, 1 through 9, I think what Solomon is saying is, you're going to see injustice and oppression in the world. And when you see it, you shouldn't make all these grand promises that arise out of your dreams about how you're going to change the world. You should respond to that by saying, I'm going to be faithful with what God has given me to do. I'm going to watch my step. I'm going to make sure that I don't sin in my response to this, that I don't overpromise what I can't deliver, and then I'm going to cultivate my field. I'm going to work and keep my garden. I'm going to do my best before God to do valid, good work that's full of integrity that honors the Lord. Okay, so 3:16 through 22, there's injustice in the world. God's going to judge. Chapter 4, here are a number of arguments against pursuing injustice and oppression. 5, 1 through 9, you're trucking along, trying to conduct yourself with integrity. You see injustice and oppression. Here's how you respond. Now, starting at 5:10 and continuing through 6:9, so 5:10 through 6:9, I think that Solomon is going to make this argument. The kind of gain that is received by those who engage in injustice and oppression will never be enjoyed. Let me put that more succinctly. You will never enjoy unjust gain. Unjust gain, ill-gotten gain, gotten in unjust ways, you will never be able to enjoy that. On the other hand, if you work in righteous ways, if you work with integrity, you will be able to enjoy as you conduct yourself by faith. And this passage, 5:10 through 6:9, it's another one of these chiastic structures. So I'm gonna start with 10 through 12, and then we'll look together at 6, 7 through 9. And I think we'll see how these passages correspond to one another. So look with me at 5:10. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is breath. Now, I think it's true in all circumstances what Solomon says here, but particularly if we're dealing with somebody who's say a corrupt official who because of their love of money, they're willing to bend the rules, to break laws. I mean, years ago, I listened to this podcast about this guy who sought to become the mayor of Providence, Rhode Island. He was a police officer, and he saw that organized crime was behind all of the things that he was having to battle as a police officer in Providence, Rhode Island. So he wanted to become the mayor of Providence, Rhode Island in order to oppose organized crime. And he lost the election. And then guess what happened? The mafia bosses came to him and they said, we can make it so you win that election. And he said, okay, deal. And he became the mayor. But he was totally in the back pocket of the crime bosses. You know, he sacrificed his principles. And then he became the very thing that he was opposing. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. The guy, it's a fascinating story, he wound up going to prison. And then he got out of prison and ran for mayor again and got reelected again because, you know, because the place was so corrupt. It's an amazing story. Verse 11, when goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? There's an article in Sports Illustrated that I read years ago about what happens to NFL football players. And they looked at one NFL football player in particular. And this guy's story was he had grown up poor, without a father, and grown up with nothing, becomes a great athletic success, goes to college to play football, gets drafted into the NFL. Now he has millions of dollars. And what the journalist was doing was explaining why it is that these guys go bankrupt. They make millions upon millions of dollars. And then I think it's the case that 5 years out of the NFL, 80% of former NFL players are either bankrupt, divorced, or addicted to drugs. 80% of them. And this particular young man's story was as soon as he started making millions of dollars, there were all these people that he felt the need to take care of. So he bought his mother a house, and he bought all his siblings cars. I mean, he spent just loads of money on family members, giving them gifts. And the next thing you know, he had no money, and then he was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and he got shot and was killed. I mean, it's just a really tragic story. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. I mean, we can understand how this works. You know, somebody who they live in plenty, maybe they don't have to work, so they don't exhaust themselves physically, and they just engorge themselves on all the delicacies that they have to eat, and then they can't sleep at night. Now look at the corresponding passage in 6, 7 through 9. All the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. That language of not satisfied is the same language of he who loves money will not be satisfied with money. For what advantage has the wise man over the fool? And what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes. Back in 5:11, what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is breath and a striving after wind. So I think Solomon is saying people pursue injustice and oppression because they love money and because they have these appetites, and they're discontent. They're not satisfied with what they have. Better to learn that if you're content with what you have, you can actually enjoy what you have than to seek all your pleasures in unjust ways and wind up ruining your life and the life of others. Next, in 5:13 through 17, Solomon is going to make statements that parallel 6:1 through 6. And here, if you look at 5:13, he says, "There is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun." The corresponding statement in 6:1, "There is an evil that I have seen under the sun." The two statements are really similar. 5:13, "Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt, and those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is a father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again, naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go. And what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger." So what Solomon is doing is drawing out the way that wealth just won't satisfy you. Wealth won't satisfy you. And as he says in Proverbs, as soon as you set your eyes on it, it sprouts wings and flies away. And you simply cannot guarantee that you're going to maintain the wealth that comes to you. And then look at this corresponding statement in 6:1 through 6. "There is an evil that I have seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor, so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God does not give him power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. This is vanity. It is a grievous evil." Maybe you've experienced this in your own life the way that I have. Every time I read this passage, I think of this occasion when these very wealthy people took me to a very fine restaurant. I mean, this was at that point in my life, it was the nicest restaurant I had ever been in. And it was one of those things where they're being kind to me, and they take me to this restaurant and they say, order whatever you want on the menu. And so I ordered probably a filet mignon, a steak, and the person that I was with, the person who was footing the bill, this was the kind of place that they ate all the time. And they order some appetizers. They bring the appetizers out, and the person finds fault with the appetizers. They're just not right. And then that person had ordered a steak, and they brought the steak out, and this person cut into the steak, and the steak wasn't cooked right, and she sent it back to the kitchen. And I mean, it was one thing after another, and I was astonished. I had never been in a place so nice. I had never eaten such fine food, and it tasted better than anything I'd ever experienced in my life. And I'm just sitting there thinking, what is wrong with you? Why? How can you not be enjoying this? This is incredible. And this is the explanation. Look at verse 2 there. A man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God does not give him power to enjoy them. The ability to enjoy what you have is a gift of God. I know a man who is very wealthy, and he worked all his life. He worked insane hours. He worked very hard. He worked very diligently. He made a ton of money. And he came to retirement, and I said, what are you going to do in your retirement? And he said, everything I've always wanted to do. And I said, well, what? And he said, oh, I'm going to travel, and we'll figure it out as we go along. They haven't gone anywhere. I mean, it's been decades. They haven't traveled. They haven't driven around the United States. It's almost like they're hermits. They live by themselves alone. They don't have interaction with other people, and they're just sitting on a mound of wealth. And God does not give him power to enjoy what he has. It's one of those things, I think, that those to whom God gives the ability to enjoy these things, we look at it and we say, there but for the grace of God go I. This is the mercy of God. It's the mercy of God that somebody can receive God's goodness and can enjoy it. So in 6:2 here, when he says God does not give him power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them, this is very similar to what Solomon had said back in 2:26, where he says, to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, but to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting only to give to the one who pleases God. There are all kinds of ways that this is realized in people's lives. In my own life, I have seen very wealthy unbelievers who cannot enjoy their all the good things that they have. I've watched them. These are unbelieving people. I've watched them scholarship seminary students pay for the education. These people don't go to church, but for some reason they decide, I'm going to pay for that person's education. And it's like an outworking of God gives the sinner the business of gathering and collecting only to give to the one who pleases God. And it's exactly what is in 6:2 as well. God does not give him power to enjoy them, but a stranger enjoys them. And Solomon says this is breath. It's a grievous evil. I think what he means is everybody should respond to God's goodness with gratitude and joy. So back in Deuteronomy 28, Moses says in Deuteronomy 28:47, because you did not serve the Lord your God with joyfulness and gladness of heart because of the abundance of all things, therefore you shall serve your enemies. So it's almost like Moses is saying, you want to know why you're going to get exiled? You're going to get exiled because you're not going to serve the Lord with joyfulness and gladness of heart. And then in verse 63 of Deuteronomy 28, Moses says, and as the Lord took delight in doing you good and multiplying you, so the Lord will take delight in bringing ruin upon you and destroying you, and you shall be plucked off the land that you are entering to take possession of it. I heard John Piper say one time in response to these two statements, Deuteronomy 28, 47 and 63, God promises terrible things if we will not be happy. God promises terrible things if we will not be happy. We're supposed to respond to God's goodness with gratitude and joy. Verse 3, Ecclesiastes 6, 3. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, and he has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. So, living 100 years and or fathering 100 children and living many years, this would be like the climactic blessing, the best way to describe the blessed life. But if he's not satisfied with life's good things, and he has no burial, probably in view of the context, because he's driven everyone away from him by his unjust and oppressive practices, a stillborn child is better than he. And these statements about a stillborn child being better than him, this is similar to chapter 4, verse 3. Better than both is he who has not yet been and has not seen all the evil deeds that are done under the sun. Verse 4 of chapter 6, for it comes in vanity and goes in darkness, and in darkness its name is covered. Moreover, it has not seen the sun or known anything, yet it finds rest rather than he. I think it's interesting here that Solomon speaks of a stillborn child finding rest, whereas someone who has pursued a life of ingratitude, even in abundance, and a failure to enjoy the goodness of God, that person does not find rest. Verse 6, even though he should live 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good, do not all go to the one place. In other words, you can extend this life of plenty out as long as you want to extend it. If you don't find satisfaction in God, it's meaningless. It's just going to end in death. Okay, so in 5, 10 through 12, riches and possessions cannot satisfy. In 6, 7 through 9, the appetite's not going to satisfy. 5, 13 through 17, the riches don't last. 6, 1 through 6, the enjoyment doesn't last. And that puts in the middle this statement in 5, 18 through 20, where Solomon sounds his rhythmic refrain. So 5:18, behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and see good in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life, because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. I suspect that, like me, you have been exposed to some Christian teachers who talk as though any possession of wealth is suspect. Probably wrong, probably unrighteous, probably to be condemned. That is not Solomon's view. Solomon's view is, if you have wealth, it's because God has given you wealth. And what you need, if you have wealth, is the ability to enjoy that wealth. And I think that this resonates also with Paul, who in 1 Timothy 6, he doesn't say to Timothy, Timothy, instruct the wealthy in this present age that they need to repent of all that wealth and give it away. No, listen to what he says, 1 Timothy 6, 17. As for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, nor to set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. They're to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, thus storing up treasure for themselves as a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is truly life. You could almost say that 1 Timothy 6, 17 through 19 there is like a three-verse summary of the message of Ecclesiastes. The wealthy, the rich in this present age should recognize that they need to take hold of that which is truly life, which is walking with God. And they need to do good. They need to be ready to share. They need to set their hope on God. This is exactly the kind of thing that Solomon is saying here in Ecclesiastes 5, 18 through 20. And he has centered this statement, I think, to communicate clearly, this is the way that you want to live. You want to live the kind of life that receives God's goodness with gratitude and joy, that sees good in the work that God has given you to do, where you have the ability to enjoy God's goodness to you. And that leaves us with the last portion, which is 6, 10 through 12. And you may remember that the first unit, which ran from 1:1 to 3:15, in that final section, starting at 3:9 after the initial question, there were these ways in which earlier statements in the book were reprised. So, you know, what has been done is what will be done, that kind of thing, where he's restating things. We're going to get the same thing here in 6:10 through 12. Look at 6:10. Whatever has come to be has already named. It's almost like every time Solomon gets to the close of a unit, he starts summarizing things that he said before. What has been is what will be. Whatever has come to be has already been named. And it is known what man is, and that he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. I think he's talking about God there. And I think he's particularly talking about the judgment. So, you know, we opened in 3:16 through 22, 3:17, I said in my heart, God will judge the righteous and the wicked. Now he's closing by saying, man is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. This language, it almost sounds like the book of Job, doesn't it? Job wants a mediator between the Lord and himself. He wants someone to intercede because he knows that he cannot dispute with one stronger than he. Same kind of idea here. Verse 11, this is what we had. This is very similar to earlier statements where Solomon has said, the more words, the more vanity. For instance, he says this in 5:2, be not rash with your mouth, nor let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God, for God is in heaven, you are on earth, therefore let your words be few. Now 6:11, the more words, the more breath, the more hot air, the more vapor. And what is the advantage to man? For who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his life of breath, which he passes like a shadow? We didn't look at chapter 2, verse 3, but look at 2:3, where he says, I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven. So he's pursuing what is good for man to do. 6:12, who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his life of breath, or his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? And we talked about how 3:22 ends with a very similar statement. Who can bring him to see what will be after him? Again, I think what Solomon is saying is, you should consider what comes after your life, both here and in the hereafter. In other words, you should think about, what is the world going to be like? What is this world going to be like when I'm gone? When I'm dead and gone, how are people going to remember me? And you should also consider, what's it going to be like for me when I stand before God and I face judgment and rewards and consequences are meted out? What's that going to look like for me? And Solomon doesn't overtly come out and say something like, your only hope is Genesis 15:6, but I think he believes that. I think he believes that, and I think it's one of his operating assumptions that he expects his audience to know. Genesis 15:6, Abraham believed the Lord, and he reckoned it to him for righteousness. He reckoned his faith as righteousness. So as Solomon makes this case against injustice and oppression, I think he's pushing his audience toward the kind of faith that justifies. And that kind of faith is the kind of faith that also is able to receive and enjoy God's goodness and be put to work for good deeds in the world. Okay, I think this is a great place for us to take a break. And so we'll take a break for how long, Ross?
10 minutes.
10 minutes, and then we'll come back and we'll look together at the next section of the book, 7:1 through 8:17.